This podcast is brought to you by Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Hello, I'm your host, Louise Taffer, with Josh Parrish. Joining me in the studio, a big hour ahead. We'll look to the semi-final in the A-League tonight, Adelaide United taking on Perth Glory. We'll also be chatting to journo Vince Rugari in about 10 minutes, so stick around for that. And we'll get through all of the latest European and local news to come. But one of the big... Oh, well, I'll say hello to you first, Josh.
Good evening, Louise.
How are you?
I'm great. I'll be sipping on tea throughout the show after nattering with Nick on the lightning round for a good hour, but keen to get stuck into some local football. And in the last 15 minutes, as we always do, we'll have a look at the European stuff.
And remember, get involved at any time. Give us a call or tweet to us at FNR_radio. Now, Josh, one of the biggest news headlines in the local game today is the fact that Ante Milicic has received a one-year contract extension and will remain as head coach of the Matildas until the completion of Australia's 2020 Summer Olympics campaign.
Brilliant. And I think it's what the Matildas probably needed, is a bit of stability over the long term. Won't just be a Bert van Marwijk type coming in and just coaching for the one tournament. I think he's shown enough in his short reign to date that he can improve the side. I think a lot of A-League teams are a little bit disappointed, especially the newcomers, MacArthur, Southwest Sydney, that he may not be joining them for their inaugural campaign, but he could still do, I suppose. But yeah, I think it's a terrific signing, and I think the players seem to have taken to him quite quickly. So, it's a two thumbs up from me.
It is. It's great to see that Ante has signed on, and it's a real reflection of just where the women's game is going at the moment.
Mm.
Because I think maybe 10 years ago, anyone would have jumped at the opportunity to coach in the A-League.
Yeah, I think you're right. In years past, a men's club job would have been considered a bigger position than the women's national team. But thankfully, that mentality has changed a lot. And, the Matildas are probably the greatest sporting brand we have in this country. I mean, just universal approval. People love this team. And Ante Milicic has seen the opportunity there with a really special group of players who he can be, vying for a world title, for a World Cup, this coming World Cup in France. And, going forward, I think they're a very young group, as we've covered many times. They've got a lot of growing to do, a lot of room to improve. So, this is a chance to achieve something special. I'm really glad that Milicic has seen the potential that is within this team and has decided to stay on.
He said, personally, I want to join the players on this journey. I know that I can help them achieve something special for themselves, not only individually, but for this team and for Australian football. And big news, he will be naming his 23-player squad for the FIFA Women's World Cup in France next week. Some big decisions on his hands.
Huge decisions, especially with regards to that sort of front third, whether some of the players like Lisa Devana and Kaya Simon make it, whether he goes for younger options like Mary Fowler and Princess Abini, whether it's a mix of the two. But, yeah, big decisions. It's difficult to know what he's going to pick. I know I wouldn't like to be in his shoes, but that's a nice dilemma to have when you've got so much quality to choose from.
I'm not quite sure the Matildas have had the best lead-in to the FIFA Women's World Cup. They've only really had 6 weeks at best to prepare for this tournament.
Yeah, it's not great. And obviously the whole Stadgers thing so close to the tournament wasn't ideal either. But, that's really FFA's fault. And Milicic has done really all he can. They have organised one extra game. Hopefully we see a couple more, just on the eve of the tournament so he can get everything right and ready. But, they're going to have to rely on evolving as the tournament progresses. And that's what you've seen with a lot of World Cup winners, male and female, is they haven't always started the tournament absolutely on fire. They've just peaked at the right time. And, fingers crossed, that's what is in store for the Matildas. Maybe game one, we won't see the absolute best of them, but they'll hopefully do enough to get through the group stage and then start to really gel and hit their stride when they get into the really important games.
Well, I think it's all going to add up. But one thing that I'm also a little bit concerned about is the amount of game time that some of the key players are currently getting in the NWSL.
Mm. Okay, go on.
Lydia Williams has only seen 90 minutes in four matches. Alana Kennedy has been playing in defence for Orlando Pride, and they have conceded 10 goals in five matches, so that can't really be too good for her confidence. And Steph Catley hasn't even seen a single minute.
That's concerning. I mean, I don't know how many of these are, you know, based on selection or injury problems or so forth.
But if these are only just three of a whole handful, but if, you know, some of the key players aren't getting enough minutes, how good can that be for them leading into this FIFA Women's World Cup, which they are meant to go deep into the tournament?
Usually I would say that that's a really huge issue, but I will say that a lot of these players have probably had too much in terms of loading on them in the past couple of years. I mean, Steph Catley especially has just probably played too many games. So maybe a bit of a rest actually isn't the worst thing in the world. They'll still be training with good players at a high intensity. I don't think fitness is going to be a huge problem for the Matildas. I really don't, and I think, you know, maybe that the camp leading into the World Cup will be the crucial factor to their preparation. But, you know, I would be less concerned than I usually would be, considering that maybe some of these players do need a break before the tournament.
Their next game is a friendly with the Netherlands on the 1st of June. So that's only a couple of weeks away as well. And that'll be another good test for them.
That'll be an acid test for where this team's really at, you know, against high quality opposition. We saw it against the US. It was a really good indication. And, you know, against the Netherlands, which is a team ranked similarly to the Matildas, you know, if they win that game and they, or if they put in a good performance at least, then we'll know they're ready for the World Cup.
Yeah, for sure. I think, as you say, it'll be a good gauge to see where the Matildas are at, similar to the hit out against the US, world number one.
Yeah, and the US, it's a bit of a weird one. You're playing at a high altitude. I mean, we saw some interesting tactics from Milicic, maybe a couple of players a little bit out of position. But I think he'll probably revert to the tried and true when it gets closer to the tournament.
I know you're not a really big fan of players playing out of position, but when you're coming into the FIFA Women's World Cup, and let's just say, you know, you do come across a time where you might have a few injured players, can that be a good backup, though, to know that you do have players who are versatile, who can fit into different positions?
I think this is just experimentation from Milicic, and has been. I think I'd
but
like to see.
I'm talking about, remember when Staj was in the role, and you know, you were saying you didn't really like the fact that he did play players out of position. Maybe he was creating depth, maybe not. But do you think that, in a sense, that it, that is good for them heading into the World Cup, knowing that some players can play different positions?
Well, versatility is important, but I think when it comes to when it's long term, when you're just putting, you know, someone like Elise Kellen-Knight at left back, who basically the entire time, then that's not just, you know, showing depth and showing that players can be versatile. That's actually just moving a player from their natural spot to somewhere that they're not really all that comfortable. And, you know, that has a negative impact on the team. So it's a balance, I suppose.
Okay. You're listening to Evenings on FNR with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And we're going to cross to our journo now. Vince Rugari joins us. Vince, thank you so much for coming on Evenings on FNR.
Hey, guys. How are you?
We're doing well. A little bit cold in Melbourne, but not too bad. I was reading one of your articles yesterday about the fact that the A-League expansion teams will now be given a bigger salary cap. Western United and Macarthur Southwest Sydney are set to have an initial salary of, what, 3.6 mil. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, 3.6 mil to 3.2 million is my understanding. And it's not confirmed yet. It's part of the ongoing negotiations for the new CBA for next season only. But from all reports from the people I've been speaking to, the thought behind it is that it would apply for the first two seasons for each new club. Although, then again, you do have the PFA who are keen to get rid of the salary cap as soon as possible. So it's a bit dicey in terms of how long for, but I can't see it being around this salary cap boost for the new clubs more than their first two seasons. And I don't mind it, to be honest. In the article, I've mentioned that it's partly to give them a leg up to make sure that they're successful from the outset, which is important, I think, but also partly to level the playing field, because these new clubs can't offer loyalty payments, because those apply for players who have been at your club for a certain amount of time and they're brand new, so they can't offer around $200,000, although my understanding is the cap may be removed entirely on loyalty payments. So if they were to come and play by the same rules that already exist, they'd actually be behind the eight ball rather than on a level playing field. This sort of gives them a little bit of a nudge, but not an extraordinary one, I wouldn't have thought. And I think it's in everyone's best interest that these teams are good from the outset. Otherwise, the consequences for the league would not be very good.
And Vince, this isn't the first time that FFA has actually given an expansion team a leg up. I mean, I do remember Western Sydney were, I think, given an extra a foreign spot, so that they could sign Shinji Ono for their first season.
Yeah, they were actually given two extra foreigner spots. They never exceeded six marquees at any given time. But yeah, at the time that it was introduced allowed them to basically make a play for Shinji Ono. And look, I mean, you know, it was an advantage for the Wanderers, but let's face it, the league was the beneficiary. He was a fantastic player, a great ambassador for the competition, built the profile of the club and the league. I've just finished another piece for tomorrow, actually, as well, having a little bit of a closer look at KSK Honda's impact on the A-League. And look, in retrospect, that rule change that allowed Shinji Ono to come to the A-League was a masterstroke, because it meant that the Wanderers weren't, overshadowed, so to speak, in their first season by a Sydney FC team that had Del Piero on deck. So anything that ensures expansion teams are successful from as quickly as possible and brings higher profile players to our league, in my opinion, with where the league's currently at, is a good thing.
I have to agree there, Vince. And how do you think the Western United squad is shaping up so far? They announced three new signings this week: Delianov, Scott McDonald and Ersin Ghulam.
Really well, actually. I'm sort of surprised that none of the Melbourne teams made a play for Ersin Ghulam. He only left Adelaide because he wanted to return to Melbourne for family reasons. Obviously, hasn't been doing much in terms of football since then. What was it, State League 1, State League 2?
Yeah, State League 1.
Something like that. It's crazy, but it's not like he was a terrible player by any means in the A-League. And I don't know if you guys have seen him play this season. I certainly haven't, but you'd like to think Western United have done their homework and have potentially, you know, snared a real leader for their defensive part of the field on the cheap there. So that's a really good signing. So is Delianov, I think, who, you know, is by all reports that the best young goalkeeper going around in Australia. Look, the squad's shaping up really well, I think. What they want, though, I think, is some pretty big fish out of the next sort of five or six names that they signed. They've got three visa spots left, one marquee spot left. You'd like to think that they'll go big for that. Bring some highly credentialed foreign players in to complement Kone. And, well, I say that they've got three visa spots left, assuming that Philip Curto is their first-rate goalkeeper, which seems to be on par with Mark Rudin to Western United, one of the worst-kept secrets in the game. We get a few of those over the journey, don't we? But no one keeps a secret like Australian soccer. it's shaping up really well, but the next signings are critical, and I'll be very interested to see what direction they take with those.
Well, we haven't seen Ersin Ghulam play. I was actually going to go watch him on Monday night, but he's since handed in his resignation at Whittlesea, so there goes that idea.
Yeah, there you go. But we'll all get to see him soon enough, I think. And for his sake, for Western United's sake and the competition's sake, let's hope he hasn't lost too much in 12 months.
When do you think Mark Rudin might be announced? Coming days?
I think after the A-League Grand Final. From what I can tell, the club doesn't really have any intention to sign it, announce it beforehand. There's no real reason to either, especially with, you know, football fighting for publicity and media space as much as it always does. Like, case in point this week, it's crazy. Like, some of the media space that would usually go to the A-League at this time of year was unfortunately swallowed up by the incredible accomplishments of Liverpool and Spurs in the Champions League. Like, you know, it's an opportunity cost type thing when it comes to football and the media, and there's no point really in Western United adding to that sort of glut by announcing something that they can just hold off on and wait till the season's over and have a little bit of a little bit of limelight of their own. which makes sense. Maybe they want to coincide it with another player signing or two, or maybe a kit reveal as well. Who knows? But he's definitely their coach.
And Vince, moving on to tonight's clash, a big game for Adelaide United and Perth Glory. What do the Reds have to do to win?
It's a good question. And look, Perth at home are a fantastic team. Basically, they've just got to hang on, be defensively strong, because Perth, with the amount of attacking weapons they have, are going to create chances. They're going to keep coming. There's expectation on them. They'll have a pretty big home crowd behind them as well. It's basically on Adelaide United to show the sort of grit and determination I think they've shown in patches throughout the season, and certainly in the game last week against Melbourne City, is be disciplined and just keep going. They eventually got the better of Melbourne City in the end last weekend, and it'll take a similar sort of performance defensively and going forward for them to beat Perth Glory, but I certainly wouldn't be putting any money on it. I think the Glory will be too good, and the grand final will be at Optus Stadium next weekend, I reckon, which I'm looking forward to. Although, you know, having said that, now that I've made the call, I reckon Adelaide will win now, knowing my luck. But anyway.
Well, it is a weird atmosphere at the moment with Adelaide United, because Marco Kerr's, you know, he's doing pretty well. I think that the fans seem to really get behind his passion and his style. But now we've got, obviously, his contract not being renewed. It looks like Gert-Jan Verbeek, no relation to Pim, is going to be the new coach for next season. So, you know, would the board and the new owners be a little embarrassed if Marco Kerr is actually able to lead this team to a grand final?
Yeah, it wouldn't be a good look for them, particularly. I didn't watch the Melbourne City game last weekend with a granular focus, but I read it in an opinion piece from an advertiser journal, which was really good, that after they scored the goal to basically win the match, Marco Kurtz looked back at like the chairman's box and yelled out a profanity, which certainly isn't the first time he's done that this season. So there's clearly weird vibes at a football club at the moment, and I guess that's what you're going to get when you've got an ownership group who are literally mystery men. No one knows who they are. And that, for me, breeds, you know, scepticism and a lack of trust in your supporter base. And when you've got a coach who you've sacked, you know, presumably reasons that, you know, about their contrasting philosophy in terms of football and what they want to get out of the future and what they sort of want to do with this football club. And you've got a coach who seems to have the players humming and you know, you can't be asking that too much of a new owner. So it's a really, really weird one. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in the next season, because, you know, it looks like Marco Kurtz has built up a really strong team culture. The players love him and that sort of thing. And you'd like to see where he could take it next, but we're not going to get the opportunity, and we're going to have some other bloke come in with a broom, no doubt, and his own ideas, and they'll be starting again. So it's strange, but that's the A-League, baby. Very, very strange competition.
It is a bit strange. We had Michael Moroney on the show last night, and he was saying that it actually came at a good time. So now that the players are actually aware of the situation, they can move forward. And I guess not necessarily the result of tonight's game really rides on Marco Kurz's shoulder in terms of his position.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain freedom that you can attack things when you know that there's big change coming. So I guess the players will attack this game with that freedom. But it's a strange time over there. And once this game's out of the way, then who knows what happens after that. You know, it's a bizarre set of circumstances, which I'm not too sure I've really seen before in the A-League. But there you go. These new owners would hope that the guy that they're bringing in is a better coach than Marco Kurtz, because that's the only way he could really justify changing coach at this time.
I wanted to touch on another article written by your Sydney Morning Herald colleague, Vince. Dominic Bossi wrote a piece about government funding for AFL over football. Half the players, twice the funding for the Oval Ball Code. What do you think football needs to do to redress this disparity?
Well, what they're doing now, to be honest, I have to say that there's certainly been a lot more government commitments towards football in the last few weeks and months than there has been in the sort of 15 years before that, stretching back to when Lowy took over. Football's never had a good relationship with government, I don't think, at any time, really. And when Lowy took over, he was you know, quite often leaning on his own personal contacts through our government, and there was no cohesive strategy behind the way we spoke to state and federal governments about the infrastructure requirements that we needed. So now that he's gone, we were sort of in no man's land for a little bit, but I do know that SFA have you know, taken the time to figure out how and what they're going to do in this space, and it seems to be coming off. But I guess the only thing is a lot of A-League fans would like to see some money being thrown at top-tier clubs, like seems to be the case for the AFL, and I agree with that as well. There's training, you know, facilities that are needed in certain cities, and one of my pet topics is a new stadium in Brisbane, which I think would be a revolutionary thing for the game to have. But we've also got a lot of need for funding at the grassroots level, and you know, good fields and lighting and change rooms and those sort of things. We're the most played game in the country, and those things add up very quickly. So, yeah, look, it's the start. We're doing well now. Not as good as the AFL, who are very, very slick operators in this space. But let's hope the more awareness we have about the disparity in funding sort of turns the dial a little bit our way in the coming years.
And Vince, looking back to the other elimination semi-final, Sydney FC are hosting Melbourne Victory. The Victory didn't take any experienced players to Korea. How much do you think that'll play into their favour this weekend?
I don't know, really, to be honest, because Sydney FC have been back since Thursday morning and left a few of their experienced players at home as well. And the game's not till late tomorrow. So I think Sydney FC will have plenty of time to rest up. And look, those Victory players have been training, you know, for a large part of the week without Kieran Muscat on deck. So I'm sure everyone at that club is across what they need to do, but I'm not sure either club has a perfect scenario this week, and I don't think one is particularly better than the other, and it's going to come down to, as always with these two clubs, what happens on the day, which no doubt will involve some new level of madness and tomfoolery, and something extraordinary will just happen, as seems to be the case whenever these two teams meet, particularly in the finals. I'm really looking forward to it. Literally anything could happen in this game.
Well, given that, Vince, are you going to give us a prediction?
Absolutely not. No. I already made one on this phone call and I immediately regretted it, so I'm not going to make a second.
Well, Vince, thank you so much for joining us on Evenings on FNR. We're looking forward to reading whatever you've got coming for us in the Sydney Morning Herald, and we'll speak to you again soon, I'm sure.
No worry, guys. All the best.
Vince Rigari, Sydney Morning Herald football reporter, joining us on the line, talking all things A-League and Australian football. With that, Louise, I think we'll take a short break. Plenty more still to come, including our own takes on the coming A-League semi-finals and a look at the exciting European football on the weekend, including Premier League race coming down to the wire.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Welcome back to Evenings here on FNR Football Nation Radio. Josh Parrish alongside Louise Taffer. And tonight's broadcast is brought to you by the Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions and one of our major sponsors here at FNR. Louise, I think it's time we took a look ahead to the ins and outs of these A-League semi-finals and what's going to happen tonight and on Sunday night.
Very exciting. Obviously, the game tonight kicks off at 8:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. Perth Glory, the Premiers, hosting Adelaide United in what will be, as I said, an interesting game because Perth's style is all about ball control and ball retention. But can the Reds manage their press? And if they do that, potentially that could see them book their spot in the A-League Grand Final.
I wonder what Adelaide United's approach to this game is going to be. I think it's going to be a little bit similar to that semi-final against City. What is Perth Glory's weakness? Probably when they can't exploit the space in behind for the likes of Economides and, you know, when Castro, I mean, he's a magic player, but when he can't have the space to thread those through balls through to their on-rushing players. So I think Adelaide United will probably sit fairly deep and it's going to make for a bit of a cagey game. Perth Glory, the emphasis is all going to be on them to break down Adelaide. And, you know, Perth, I think they like a little bit more of an end-to-end contest. So, you know, that's not going to be ideal, but I still think they've got the quality. Adelaide held them to a 0-0 draw already at HPF Park this season, and Adelaide had some players out. But I do think, you know, Perth with the likes of Economides and Castro will be good enough. The one question mark I have is Neil Kilkenny, who's still under an injury cloud for this game, and that could be a major, major deciding factor because, for me, he's been the best central midfielder in the league this season.
We didn't even hear what his injury was, like the extent and an update on that.
No, we haven't heard anything.
What happened last, if you're just joining us, what happened last Saturday in training? He went down with a knock on his ankle. At the time, the reports were saying it was maybe ligament damage, but that hasn't been confirmed yet. So we don't know if he's in
the fact that we haven't heard anything leads me to suggest that he probably won't be playing. I think he's what I've heard is that he's in doubt for this game, but he'll probably be right for the grand final if they get through. I think you can expect to see One Day and Jake Brimmer in the middle of the park, which makes Perth just a little bit weaker in terms of finding those gaps, finding the players in the front three, breaking down Adelaide's defence. So I think it's going to be really tight as a result, and also just because of Adelaide's defensive discipline and the way they set up. And Marco Kerr's, he's got this energy about him, as we heard from Vince, you know, the way he turned around and gave the owner's box a piece of his mind at Hindmarsh the other week. I think he's got a little bit of a, you know, chip on his shoulder because his contract isn't being renewed. And for Marco Kerr's, that's a bit of a powerful thing, and I think that motivation will be passed on to his players. So I think it's going to be a long, drawn-out fight tonight.
And the players arrived, as we heard from Michael Moroney on Evenings on FNR last night. He was saying they arrived an extra day earlier in Perth, in Western Australia, just to get used to everything and settle and make sure that they're all ready to go for tonight's big game. Because I think that both teams would ideally like to finish it in 90 minutes, not see it go to 120.
Certainly, I mean, Adelaide, they probably try and draw it out as long as possible, but they've already played 120 minutes against Melbourne City. I wonder how physically, you know, well the players are at this point. The lineup, the defence is a big question mark. Whether does Jordan Elsie come back into the starting 11 because he's been struggling with his injury problems this season? I think yes. I think they'll have Moroney at right back, Galloway at left back, and then the familiar defensive pairing that we haven't seen enough of this season, Jakobsen and Jordan Elsie, coming into the middle of that heart of that defence. And that way you don't have to have Moroney and Issa just playing out of position. So that will strengthen Adelaide's resolve even further. So I'm going to say 1-0 to Perth. Whether it's in the 90 minutes or in extra time, I'm not sure. I think it's going to be really tight, but I think they've just about got enough to break down this team. And Adelaide will do everything they can to make it physical, to make it uncomfortable, and to make it difficult for Perth.
I'm going to agree with you there. 1-0 to Perth. I think they'll get through. You're right. They're very good at breaking down teams, and I can't really see it going any other way. But my tipping this week has been unusually off, which I hope it's not getting worse.
I mean, the A-League is a nightmare to tip, as Vince Rigari told us in the last segment. He almost flat out refused to give a prediction for the Big Blue. And I don't blame him, because it's such an unpredictable competition, and that's one of the things that makes it interesting.
I think one thing that is unpredictable is the finals. It doesn't always go to script.
And that's kind of the point, isn't it? You know, the fact that there are these one-off knockout games under pressure, who can emerge, who can, you know, come up in the big moments. Is it about who the most consistent team is over the course of the season? Absolutely not. It's about who can do it on the day. And Tony Popovich has struggled, especially in grand finals, you know, in A-League seasons past. So, you know, maybe next week there's a bit of a mental barrier, but for this game, I'm going to go with Perth Glory, and I think they can get it done. Adelaide, though, you know, they're one of the few teams to hold Perth Glory scoreless at home this season. And they do have maybe the X factor in Bubba Diawara coming back.
Does he start?
No, I don't think he will. Adelaide have pretty much a clean bill of health. You know, only Kel Neilso has departed the club. He's out. You know, the rest of them are all in contention. There's a few injury clouds, of course. I don't think Bubba Diawara will start. I think they'll go with more mobile option in Ben Halloran up front. I wonder whether they'll start George Blackwood or not. Maybe they might go with a more defensive midfield three of Vince Lea, Mirko Boland and Isaias, which will just create a wall in front of that defence. And, you know, it won't be pretty if they go that way, but I can see Marco Kerr's thinking that that might be the best way to stifle Perth Glory.
And let's just talk a little bit about Isaias, because he's very similar in a sense that he is also a midfield magician, similar to Castro.
I think they're different players in a way. Because,
they're not the same, no, but they've got similar qualities.
They've got similar attributes in terms of the technical quality. I think Castro is much more of a, you know, creative player, whereas Isaias, you know, he does create from deep, but he's also, you know, one of his greatest skills is his gamesmanship, his ability to sort of play on the edge of a foul, get away with things, you know, stop quick free kicks, all that kind of stuff. You know, he sort of messes up the game, riles up his opponents and, you know, gets away with it. And, you know, I say that, you know, with affection. I think that's a skill set when you're playing in that position that he does. You know, Castro, you know, much more, he can't defend at all. He doesn't defend at all, but he doesn't really need to. That's not his role in the team. Whereas Isaias is, you know, much more of a defensive player.
If we do not see Neil Kilkenny in the squad tonight, is that where the game will be won and lost in the midfield?
I don't think it'll be won and lost, but I think it will make it more difficult for Perth. I think it's going to make it a more drawn out and, you know, less free flowing game with him not there. I mean, Jake Brimmer does have ability and we've seen him play quite a few games this season, but he just doesn't have, you know, that range and of passing, that vision that Neil Kilkenny has shown. So, you know, maybe it makes him a little less fluid going forward. I think there's a big selection question whether Joel Chianese plays or not. I think I would go with the front three of Economides, Castro and Keogh. But maybe Tony Popovich will want the hard work and the running and the pressing of Joel Chianese, and maybe he'll bench, you know, one of Keogh or Castro and come on as a super sub. Because we have seen Chianese play a lot of minutes this season and he has been trusted. But I don't think he's finishing. Just his end product in the final third is good enough for a game like this when you need players who will convert those chances, because you're not going to get that many of them against Adelaide.
No, and you certainly have to take your chances, whatever chances you do get in this game.
Yeah, and I think Chianese, he's been a bit inconsistent with his finishing. All his lead-up play has been very good. He's worked really hard. His movement is good, but, you know, he just hasn't in the big games. You know, I think of those games against them, especially Melbourne Victory when they were playing them at home, where Chianese missed quite a few opportunities, and that's going to cost them in a finals game. So I think, you know, Tony Popovich should go with Castro, Economides and Keogh as the front three, with maybe Santalab as the super sub if they need him.
First v. Fourth playing each other tonight at 8:30pm Australian Eastern Standard Time, 6:30pm local. Moving on to the other elimination semi-final in the A-League, the two teams will clash against each other on Sunday at Jubilee Stadium for what will be the 50th meeting between Sydney FC and Melbourne Victory. We touched on with Vince the fact that the Victory didn't take any of their experienced players over for their Asian Champions League clash. Will this play into their favour? Will it not? Are we reading too much into that? Have they rested enough?
I think it will make a difference, especially if the game goes to extra time. I think this game might go the distance. These two teams are so close to each other in terms of standard and ability this season. I think Victory have the better squad, but Sydney have arguably outplayed them, especially, you know, in Sydney. And Victory saved one of their worst performances for that last away game, you know, in Sydney. So, you know, they've got something to prove. I would go with Victory just because, you know, they seem to turn up for the big games. They've got decisive players like Toivonen, especially, is in red hot form. Victory will need to set up in a way that is they're able to defend against the overlapping fullbacks, which we've known Sydney for several seasons now has been a feature of their game. You know, it used to be Wilkshire, now it's Ryan Grant. Zulo, the constant on that left-hand side. And Victory's,
well, Zulo returns as you touch on it.
Victory's diamond is too narrow to defend against that those overlapping fullbacks. And I really hope Kevin Muscat has learnt from that in the last game and he will adjust, because that 4-3-3 he went with Cam Sober and Costa Barbarousis on the wings against Wellington, you know, the formation changed a little bit throughout the game, but that's the shape I would like to see Victory play in this game, because otherwise Antonis and Honda are going to get exposed, you know, on the left and right of that diamond.
So would you have two strikers up front, Toivonen and Barbarousis?
I would have a front three of Cam Sober, Toivonen and Barbarousis, with, you know, the wide players tracking back.
Yep.
And I would have a midfield three of Baena, Antonis and Honda. I think that suits all the players in their lineup, and it counters a few of those threats that Sydney have, because Barbarousis and Cam Sober especially, hard workers, and they will track back against the fullbacks.
And you certainly don't want Ryan Grant getting up that wing. And
he's outstanding. He's just amazing.
Putting any balls into the box, because we know that there's goal poachers in the box like Adam Lafondre who can certainly convert a goal.
Absolutely. I mean, he's just so relentless. He just keeps going all day, and he's a menace. And Victory can't afford to let him put free deliveries into the area, because as we saw, you know, they didn't deal with them when they last played Sydney, and they don't have to just score directly off a header or off a, you know, low cross and a finish, and second balls falling to Ninkovic and so forth is still a threat. So I think that's the main tactical dilemma for Vitry. There's two, really. There's the fullbacks overlapping, and then there's Miloš Nikovic coming inside. Mm. And do you follow him? If you're Thomas Ding playing at right back, do you follow him all the way infield, or do you pass him off to a midfield player and then leave yourself open to an overload in the middle of the park? And that's difficult, because if your winger's not tracking back and your fullback's gone inside to follow Ninkovic, Zulo's got a clear lane.
And it also raises an interesting point, because the art of defending has become more zonal now, not man marking.
Yeah, 100%. And I think Vitry need to think about their structures in that way. I think you can't follow Ninkovic all the way, because he's going to roam from his position. That's what he does. You can't just have Thomas Ding running all the way from right to left on the field following Miloš Ninkovic.
No, because to open too many gaps up behind the defenders.
You have to have the midfield a little bit more aware, especially Baena really directing traffic in that holding role, or even if it's Valeri. I would probably play Baena in this game, but you know, if it's Valeri, he has to take up that role and really have disciplined strategy when you're passing players off. You can't have, you know, two players just letting Ninkovic go and thinking the other one's got him, because that's terminal against Sydney FC. Ninkovic will punish you for that.
And the midfield is, well, close to the last line of defence. You want to try and stop them in the mid if you can.
You can't let Ninkovic run at your centre-backs, because he's just going to tear them apart. You can't let him go between the lines. You're right. The midfield has to be that you know, the barrier. Otherwise, he'll tear you apart. He's one of the best players in the league.
One thing I am a little bit concerned about for Sydney FC is how good Ola Toivonen is, whether it be from open play or set pieces.
Ola Toivonen is on fire. I mean, Vitry, whether it's on the counter-attack, whether it's, you know, creating chances against a set defence, he's got everything in his locker. He was absolutely magic. One of the best individual performances I think we've ever seen. In an A-League game against Wellington Phoenix, that chip to cap it off, the pass for Barbarousis, the turns and the touches, you know, he's a class above, and he's on fire at the moment. He's got his body right. He's missed about 8 games due to injury this season, but, you know, he seems, fingers crossed, to be 100% fit and firing, and I don't know if Sydney can handle him. If Vitry can actually feed him the ball and combine, start getting those little 1-2s with Barbarousis, with Honda and Antonis coming in to support, you know, he's a tough player to stop.
Very tough, which is why I think Melbourne Vitry will just edge Sydney FC in this game.
Mm. Yeah, I think so too. I think it's probably, I'm going to go for 2-1 to the Vitry in extra time.
I'm going to say 1-0 to Melbourne Vitry.
1-0. So a couple of tight games, you reckon? Not free scoring?
No, I don't think so. But then again, maybe it could be 2-1. Vitry.
Well, yeah, I think Vitry have enough. It could even go to penalties. But I think Sydney...
You think it would go penalties?
Maybe. I think Sydney will tire, maybe if it goes the distance, if they've gone away for the Champions League. I think that does put a strain, no matter, you know, what kind of spin they want to put on it. I know Sunday, you know, is an advantageous time slot, because it gives both teams, but especially the Sydney first team, time to recover. But I still think, you know, those miles on the legs really will tell in the end.
That game kicking off on Sunday, as you touch on, Josh, at 7 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time, Sydney FC hosting Melbourne Vitry. Josh, we're going to take a quick break, but our Euro wrap still to come.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Josh, it's time for our European preview and a look ahead to what the weekend has in store. But there's plenty going on. In the English Premier League, probably one of the greatest title races in history is set for an epic crescendo. And Australian Matty Ryan could be a key part in how this ends.
Well, his team Brighton will have to play spoiler if Liverpool are going to lift that elusive league title that they haven't won in so many barren years. 1 point between the top two teams. I mean, it's nuts. I mean, 95 to 94 points. I mean, Liverpool could finish on 97 points and not win the league, which is just preposterous. But that's the way things go when you've got a financial and footballing juggernaut in Manchester City to contend with. And I have to say, you know, Liverpool have done well to keep pace with them, given the endless resources that the City Football Group seem to have at their disposal. They've both won 5 on the trot in the Premier League. You know, it's nuts, the higher level that these two are operating at. The next team is on 71 points. which shows you that they talk about the top six. There's really a top two, and then there's four. There's a little mini league being played out for the top four, but Manchester City and Liverpool have been on a different footballing level this season, and they've both been magnificent in their own respective ways. I think Brighton will put up a fight. The fact that they're already safe from relegation maybe means there's less to play for, but they are a proud club. Matty Ryan's great between the sticks, and they have one of the best centre-back partnerships outside of the top six in Lewis Dunk and Shane Duffy, who will make things difficult. They're big physical players. You're not going to give anything to City easily, and they will sit deep and, you know, try and force City to throw numbers forward and then try and hit them on the counter-attack.
Yeah, I can't see Brighton getting past Man City in this game.
They don't have to win. They can just take a point. And, you know, I could see it happening, but Liverpool have got arguably a tougher, well, not even arguably, I think it's just definitively a tougher game playing Wolves. I know they are at home, but, you know, Wolves have had such a good record against the top six teams. They seem to always take points off those teams above them because they're so good on the counter-attack, and Liverpool have to win this game, so they can't, you know, play things cautiously. So it's no sure thing, even if Brighton take points off City, it's no sure thing that Liverpool will get the win over Wolves. So I think Manchester City have to be outright favourites for this one. I think the Leicester game was probably the one that got away for our Liverpool fans. Kelechi Iheanacho had to put that chance in the back of the net. Vincent Kompany scored a goal for, you know, the ages that you never think he would score, but that's the way things go. And I think Manchester City will be the ones lifting the Premier League title on Monday morning Australian Eastern Standard Time.
Yes, as do I. I think Manchester City will take out the 2018-19 English Premier League title. They'll get it done against Brighton and Liverpool. Whatever happens with their results against Wolves, I think Wolves will put up a good fight. Currently seventh, and they have had 16 wins this season. That's pretty good for a newly promoted team who have recruited impressively.
It's outstanding. And if they could get results against the bottom six like they do against the top six, then they'd be even higher up in the table. You know, if you put the top six or top seven, I guess, including Wolves, all their results against each other in their own little mini league, Wolves are right up there. You know, it's outstanding the way that they play against the higher teams, which is why they're going to give Liverpool problems, because of their game plan, because they always test those teams who throw numbers forward because they're just a counter-attacking machine. Against those bottom six teams who defend against them and, you know, don't give any easy space away, they do struggle. So that's the next step for Wolves, is to develop their game a little bit further so that they can play against set defences.
Stay tuned for 2019-2020.
Well, they could be a Champions League team next season. They could really upset the apple cart with the funding that they've got behind them, with the savvy recruitment policy that they've displayed. They've been a real success story. You know, maybe they're not a plucky underdog given the ownership and the money behind them, but it's going to be really interesting next season to see who they buy, because they're not going to let go of anyone easily. Usually when a team like this has an outstanding season, all their players get snapped up by the top clubs immediately. I don't think that's going to happen in this case.
No. And I think that given that they are just behind Manchester United are in a very, very difficult position at the moment. I think it'll at least be about 5 years until we see them back to the team that they once were. I think next season, if they don't recruit properly, they could be seventh and below, which is not good for a club who was once a big giant.
Yeah, I think United are a long way off, just in footballing terms, off Manchester City and Liverpool. They've wasted so much money. They've just wasted so much money. And, you know, they do need a bit of a clean out. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is the permanent coach, but I don't think he's shown enough to really get that contract. Ed Woodward surely can't fire him now. He would look like a complete idiot. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think United made a mistake in signing Solskjaer to that deal when everything, if you looked at the stats, pointed to them outperforming their expected goals. So they should have gone hard for Pochettino in the off-season, and they won't be able to do that. Instead, they're going to have to try and fix things in terms of a director of football.
Well, that's exactly right. They need someone to deal with those football operations side of things. There are a number of players who should be on their way out. Lukaku, I'm looking at you. Sanchez, I'm also looking at you.
It's going to be hard to offload these guys, though, because their wages are so high.
It has to be done over a couple of transfer windows.
And
it can't just
be
done in one.
They might have to take cut price transfer fees, or they might even have to, you know, let some of these guys, you know, pay some of them out. There are transfers that happen where players on exorbitant wages, you know, the parent club will essentially pay £30,000, £40,000, £50,000 per week of their wages just to get them to get out the door and move on to a new club. And that might be what United has to cop to get rid of these guys like Alexis Sanchez on ridiculous salaries.
Manchester United do take on Cardiff City in this last round of the English Premier League. Look, I don't even know if Manchester United might win this.
I don't think it really matters that much. I mean, Cardiff City are already relegated. I don't think they're going to put up a huge fight, but you never know.
It'd
you
be
know,
Manchester United, United's
United
luck
drew
that they
with
do win.
Huddersfield last time, and they've only got 15 points. So
I know.
That's nothing would surprise me, if I'm perfectly honest. But Louise, we can't just talk about the English side of things, because there's a couple of other leagues that are shaping up pretty exciting. Borussia Dortmund is still in with just that. I mean, they nearly shot themselves in the foot here, but they're still in with a shout of knocking Bayern off. Only 4 points between them. Leipzig has to beat Bayern, essentially.
Yes,
tomorrow
to do
night
Dortmund a favor.
At 11:30 p.m. That's shaping up as a fantastic contest. If Dortmund are going to have any chance, Leipzig has to win. There's a couple of games left. And also, just the top four race is unbelievable. I mean, we were covering on the lightning round earlier, but Wolfsburg, Mönchengladbach, Bayer Leverkusen, and Eintracht Frankfurt all within 2 points of each other in that fourth to seventh. And then, you know, Leipzig aren't in any danger, but I don't know. I couldn't pick it. Who's going to make that top four? That fourth spot is unbelievably tight.
It's pretty fascinating. And as you touch on, given first v second with Dortmund and Bayern Munich, I think that if Leipzig can do Dortmund a favour, then suddenly Dortmund are back in the race to take out the Bundesliga title, something that hasn't happened in quite some time, given Bayern's dominance.
I don't think they've won a title since Jurgen Klopp was there, if I'm not mistaken. So, I mean, Dortmund have Fortuna at home. They should beat Dusseldorf, I think. Mönchengladbach on the road on the last day of the season is the tough one. And Bayern, you know, obviously away to Leipzig, you know, they pretty much Leipzig have to win. And then they've got Eintracht Frankfurt at home. So two tough games for Bayern. I think they'll just about get over the line, even if Leipzig beats them. You know, their home record is pretty good, and they seem to have righted the ship this season. I think Bayern will win the title. It's 4 points over two games. It will be a historic collapse for the Bavarians, but stranger things have happened.
I would love to see Dortmund take out the Bundesliga title. They've been playing some outstanding football this season. In particular, one player who I've loved to see make his way to Germany from England, which is Jadon Sancho.
Yeah, he's been very impressive. I mean, even Paco Alcacer has proved a lot of people wrong, you know, after he flopped it at Barcelona. Axel Witsel coming back from China. I mean, there's been so many interesting stories. Guerrero is one of the best left-backs in the world, I would say. Pulisic done extremely well, and he's obviously getting a move to Chelsea. And then Mario Götze has been a bit of a revival for the guy who dropped off the radar almost after scoring that winner in the World Cup final that many years ago. And he's looking closer to his old self. So it's been a great season for them, but they seem to have just over the last few games really choked, if I'm honest. I mean, that loss to Schalke, they drew with Werder Bremen. I mean, you know, there's pretty shocking results. And they also went down 5-0 to Bayern a couple of weeks ago. So in all honesty, despite how exciting they've been to watch, they are not the best team in Germany, and I don't think they're going to win the title.
Okay. Moving on to the Serie A, what's going on in Italy?
Well, the title is long wrapped up.
Well, we know that Juve's already taken it out. It's been like a month and a half now.
Yeah, Juventus is 89 points, well clear of Napoli. Those two will qualify for the Champions League. It's that race for the final two spots. Inter Milan and Atalanta currently occupy them, 63 and 62 points respectively, but just nipping at the heels, AC Milan, the dysfunctional club under Gennaro Gattuso, still just about hanging in there. Roma on 59 points as well, and Torino, I think, are probably just about out of it on 57, but have done terrifically well, you know, flown under the radar, and they're such an underdog financially in Serie A. If you look ahead to these games, and our own Nick DiBano penned a piece on footballnationradio.com about the title run-in and his predictions. Roma have Juventus at home on the weekend. I can't see them winning that game. Atalanta have Genoa at home. They should probably win that one. I mean, they're very much in form and are maybe the most exciting team to watch in Serie A. Napoli as well play some fantastic football. Milan on the road to Fiorentina, which I think is about even odds whether they win that game or not. I mean, Fiorentina have had a decent season. But, you know, they, I think, underperformed given the squad that they have. Maybe they've got a point to prove. They lost four out of their last five games, so it's really gone pear-shaped for them in the second half of the season. And, you know, just looking at some of the other contenders for that spot, Torino at home to Sassuolo, Lazio away to Cagliari. I think those will be two wins for those two clubs. I'm going to say Atalanta is going to make Europe. I think they will sneak in there. I would love to see them in the Champions League next season. They're very free scoring. You know, they've got Duvan Zapata up front and so many creative players in support of him. They've scored 43 goals and 71 goals. I should say that's 43 against, you know. 71 goals is the highest goal tally in Serie A. It's more than Juventus have scored. They have conceded 43, though, which is the number I erroneously read just now, which is... shows how open they are, but for comparison, Inter Milan are a point ahead. Atlanta have scored nearly 20 more goals than them. They're on 52.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. And I do love this Atalanta side. I really want to see them in Europe next season. I think they can just about do it
and
with
Atalanta
the final few games.
Was seventh last season. That's where they finished. So it's great to see them continue their run and move further up the table in 2018-19.
Yeah, I mean, they've certainly built. I mean, the last few games, they've got a Coppa Italia final against Lazio to come on Thursday the 16th, so next Thursday. So that's going to be difficult for them in terms of the scheduling, but they've got Atalanta, Juventus away, and Sassuolo at home. I think they can get 6 points out of that, and they should be enough to propel them into Europe next season.
And moving on briefly to Ligue 1, top four is pretty much wrapped up.
Yeah, it's pretty much done. I think
PSG, LOSC, Lyon, and Saint-Étienne.
Yes.
Montpellier has just missed out.
LOSC being Lille, by the way. That's their sort of abbreviation in France. I think it's been a little bit disappointing that Lille couldn't keep up their charge, and Lyon as well. PSG has just got too much financial muscle for those teams, and it's really turned Ligue 1 into a one-horse race. Season after season after season. Monaco did win the title not too long ago with that historic team with Mbappe and Bakayoko and Fabinho and, you know, and Bernardo Silva. All those guys have been snapped up, and that team, you know, has nearly been relegated. They're just hanging in there, 3 points from the drop from the playoff. So, you know, Thierry Henry, it's been tough for him. Monaco, a long way from where they used to be, but Ligue 1, I think PSG, it's too good. They've got too much in terms of financial resources, and the Champions League has been their, you know, the elusive one for them, but I think they're going to keep winning Ligue 1 titles year after year if this continues and, you know, financial fair play doesn't come into, you know, more stringent regulations in Europe.
Hopefully some of the clubs around them can start to bridge the gap even more. Josh, thank you for your company tonight. Thank you for your company at home. We'll catch you again on Monday to wrap up all of the weekend's action. Bye for now.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.